Light beer, dark money. Agree on something. Politics, culture, and the intersection of faith, freedom, and free enterprise. And now, live from the Star Worldwide Network studios, here are your hosts, Light Beer Chris Clements and Dark Money Sean Noble.
Welcome back, Light Beer Dark Money. I'm Sean Noble.
I am Chris Clements.
We've got a
broadcasting from an undisclosed location.
we've actually got a great guest. This fits very nicely with our podcast because while he, just like Chris, he's no longer necessarily in the beer business. We have our special guest today is David Rare, who for many years, and how I got to know him, was the head of the National Beer Wholesalers Association.
Actually, put the National Beer Wholesalers Association on the map, I would say.
Oh, no question.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Both from a outreach standpoint, a PR standpoint, a PAC standpoint, and you have to know, David, all those people never left. They're all still there.
Well, yeah. And
you're the only one who's left.
Yeah.
The one thing I will say about David is he is one of the most skilled lobbyists. Or maybe was. I don't know. You probably don't do that anymore. He's now a professor, basically teaching people how to lobby. Is that an accurate way to put your career trajectory?
Yeah, that's correct. I teach graduate students and undergraduate students about lobbying and how to be successful in the business.
Well, I can't think of anybody better to be teaching. I mean, I was just a kid on the Hill, wet behind the ears. And I never felt more important than when you came in the door. Just did a great job.
Well, I think David also understood, and we've talked about it on the show a little bit, the most important people in a congressional office is the staff.
Right.
Not necessarily the member. And that's one thing I remember when we would, you know, we would meet there at the Washington, the Hyatt Regency on the Hill, and you would give your pep talk and tell us to go charge the Hill, and we weren't going to take no for an answer. And you gave these inspiring speeches, but one thing that you always emphasized was be kind and generous to the staff, because when you're kind and generous to the staff, you get things done.
Yeah. Because a lot of people, unfortunately, aren't kind and aren't generous.
Yeah.
So you differentiate yourself as being a nice person, which a lot of staff people really appreciate, especially these days.
No question. David, talk to us a little bit about, I mean, you've had a very illustrious career, and it wasn't just beer wholesalers. You also did National Association of Broadcasting, something that's a little bit near and dear to my heart, having been a broadcasting major in college. That's what I got my degree in. Not that I've used it, but, you know, I guess I'm using it now. And you're a professor at George Mason University.
Right. Yes.
And so how did you get there? Talk to us a little bit about how you got here, but also what advice you'd give people coming into the advocacy world, the political world, that kind of thing. I mean, how does someone get to be David Rare?
Yeah. So I was thinking about that. I'll give you the hopefully very short but important version. I came, as you guys know, I came from the Chicago area many years ago. My father was a postman, never went to college. We lived a kind of working class life, but he always said, you work hard, you believe in America, it gives you a lot of opportunity. Then I went to college in Minnesota, met a guy named Vin Weber who ran for Congress and won in 1980 with Ronald Reagan. And the night he won, he looked at me and said, you want a job on Capitol Hill? And I kind of looked around and said, well, I don't have a job. Sure, I'll take a job. So then I came to Washington. I worked on Capitol Hill. From that 5 years of experience, I really honed in on how it was successful advocates were able to convince people to persuade people to heighten their issues, to get their issues across to people, get their jobs done. And then I left there, went to the NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, which represents small business people, and really have always loved small business people. They're very entrepreneurial. They kind of have nothing. They begin with nothing and they just build on it. I mean, they use rubber bands if they have to create value for people, and work there 5 years. And then from there, as Chris knows, I went to the Beer Wholesalers, which was a fabulous experience and a great job. I love the Beer Wholesalers. They're great family-owned businesses across the country. They do more than they know. Did that for 7 years. We did a lot of great stuff there. Became a, I think, the 12th most influential group in Washington, D.C. And the group before us was the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And they had 30 times the money and 25 times the staff. From there, I went to be president and CEO of the National Association of Broadcasters, which was a $50 million organization with members, all radio and TV members in the U.S. and maybe 30 countries around the world. And that was a great experience, much harder than the Beer Wholesalers because they had a lot of divergent interests and they would fight all the time about what was important. But I learned a lot from it. And then I started having children and they were getting older and I was never around. I really didn't enjoy my life. I made a lot of money, but I didn't really get the satisfaction of being a good father, good husband, you know, and I just decided I'll make a change. Luckily, when I was at the NFIB and the Beer Wholesalers, I was able to finish up getting my PhD in economics. So I was able to rebrand myself as an academic without really being an academic. I was at George Washington. And then I left there, went to the George Mason Law School, now called the Scalia Law School. And then from there, walked 300 feet down the hall and joined the Schar School of Policy and Government at George Mason. I've been there for about 3 years.
Well, it feels like it's a perfect fit. One, it's a great university, but two, you just have such a depth of experience that, man, the students, I hope they know how lucky they are, because what you bring to the table.
I'll just tell one quick example. Yeah. In my current class, I have a student. Now, we teach, my job as a professor is not to indoctrinate people. I tell everybody, here's where I'm coming from. But you can come from wherever you want to come from. It's no judgment. I just want you to know all the different alternatives so you can make up your own mind. I'm a pretty big free speech guy. I think we need to have free ideas, etc. So one of my current students, who's a great student, but we probably have nothing in common. She's a progressive from Pennsylvania. In one of the classes a few weeks ago, I said, you guys could do me a favor. If you ever see the dean of our school, just tell him you're in my class. She raised her hand and said, I had lunch with the dean. I'm like, oh, God, what did she say? And she said, well, I told him, you're my favorite professor, and this is my favorite class, because you bring in so much real world experience, and I have guests come in. You know, I know how to be an entrepreneur when it comes to being a professor as well. Right. And she said, you know, this class, I didn't think I would like. It's taught me so much. It's so practical that I'll be able to use this in my life. And I'm like, well, that's exactly what I want. So, you know, I want to have the students walk away with not only knowing about what I know, maybe me influencing them in a positive way, although they can make their own decisions on everything, but just leaving people with things about how to make the country a better place.
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me when in all the interactions that we had over the years, was you have always been a shining example of kindness. Doesn't matter what the partisan divide is, doesn't matter what the ideological divide is, you see people for being people. And, you know, I think that in this political environment, we need as many David Rares as we can possibly have, because we need to teach kids that it doesn't have to be as crazy as it is. It can be a civil place to be. I mean, this is, you know, civilization, for crying out loud.
But also, I mean, David, you're very passionate about what you believe. believe. I've always known you to be a passionate person. You have a philosophical core, which seems to be a topic of discussion a lot in politics these days, because there's so many candidates and people serving in government who have no philosophical core. And yet you're able to teach it in a way that obviously with this one student that you described, you know, draws people in, makes them feel comfortable about what they believe, to be able to share that openly, but also create an environment where all beliefs are respected and desired.
Right, right. Well, I think the comment about me being nice, you know, I think of it as an economist, I think everything is via self-interest. How can I get people to like me more? Be nice to them. You know, be honest, be truthful. And a couple of the lessons that I'll leave you in just a minute or two would include that. If you're nice to everybody, people have much prefer nice people than they prefer not nice people. At least that's how I think about life. But I also, you know, am the one thing I teach all my students, which I've been doing now for 10 years on and off, is that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Lord Acton said it in the British Parliament. I think it's so true. You know, when you're in our government and you're waited on and you're, everybody wants something from you and they tell you how wonderful you are and how tall you are and how great looking you are, how smart you are and how brilliant you were, it goes to your head and you suddenly become an egomaniac and you lose perspective on life. Where if you're humble and nice and you care as much about the garbage man as you care about a member of Congress, I think that is more reflective of what America is really about.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
What, okay, so you've had different iterations of your career. What would you say were the biggest lessons coming from your time on the Hill?
Yeah. So the biggest lesson there was, one, you need to be constituent oriented. You can't forget the people who elect you,
right,
although many members do after they've been in office for a long time, because they just lose sight of going back home or connecting with people, because 94.6% of members of Congress get reelected. You almost have to be an idiot to get defeated in the poll. I mean, you do, but it's usually they make mistakes and their egos take over and they don't want to go home. They, you know, they just don't want to do things anymore. They're rude to people, et cetera. Secondly, I found early on being a staffer that the lobbyists I liked were different. And what I talk to the students about now is the importance of differentiation. Mm-hmm. You know, there are 16,000 lobbyists in D.C. How do you get remembered? How do they remember your organization? You know, we did this, Chris, at the Beer Wholesalers when we were climbing in influence. I generally am obsessive about thinking, what's the competition and what do I do to be different so I get remembered or the organization I work for gets remembered? So that'd be the second lesson. And the third lesson was this being nice to people. I remember I met a North Carolina police officer at the back of the Cannon House office building. And he was a really nice guy. We talked. But every morning I'd say, good morning, officer. How are you doing today? And I remember having to come in and being rushed to get to a meeting once. And the metal detectors were in and we were going through the line. And there was like 20 people in front of me in the line. And he pointed up his hand. He pointed up his finger, pointed at me, said, you get up here, get through the line. And I thought to myself, being nice pays off.
Yep.
I didn't have to wait 20 minutes to get through the line with all the visitors. And I was authentic about liking him because he was a really cool guy. But secondly, being nice really does pay off to people because it's a way you can differentiate yourself.
It, which is awesome, but it's also a sad commentary, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, it is. Completely is.
Kind of differentiates yourself.
And it's getting sadder because of the rise of social media where we lose common respect and manners towards each other. In my opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For sure.
What, when you look at, you know, where you've been in your career and where the nation has been over the course of the last 20, 30 years, What keeps you up at night? What do you worry about?
Well, I worry that we're going to undermine the nation through massive inflation. I know it's the talk of Washington, and people are seeing it reflective in gas prices and in food prices, and we're having shortages like a baby formula now, et cetera. But this has been going on for a while. We live above our means in America. And I think we need to think about trying to just, we don't have to dramatically change things, but just pull in a little bit, you know, because otherwise, if we destroy the currency, a lot of bad things are going to happen to a lot of bad people. And we've been inflating the currency through the Fed for at least the last 3 or 4 years, maybe even longer.
Yeah, that is a deep concern.
This and is, I have this four is
your,
kids.
Your PhD so, in economics coming through, huh?
Yeah, and I have four kids, and I'm like looking at them going, I've had such a great life. America's been so great to me. I want to try to preserve that so you could experience too. And I worry by the growth of government. I mean, we have to have a lot of programs which take care of people. We have a lot of programs that we could get rid of too, or we need to make choices. We're going to choose A or B, not that, oh my God, we're going to have A, B, and C, and we're just going to put the debt off onto my children's children, because that all adds up.
Well, and this is a good segue into what your project, you've been working on this for a long time, your TransparaGov. Talk to us about that, why you think it's important. I think it's important, but you know.
Well, so the good news is it's a great idea. The bad news is politicians and people of government don't want it.
They hate it.
Of course
they hate it. They don't want it. It's a great thing for citizens because they can see almost instantly where the money's being spent and where it's going. It's a bad thing for politicians because they can't hide money where it's being spent and where it's going. Yeah. So I had this idea, I don't know, 10 years ago, I'd form a company, we call it TransparaGov. We would, because of the internet and the power of the internet, we would put all financial transactions on in real time as possible so people could see where there's money, their money's being spent. You know, and I would go to doors, I would talk to senators, I would talk to governors, I'd talk to congressmen. And on both sides, it really didn't get anywhere because it is hard work, one, but two, they don't really want it. They don't really want to support transparency for a whole variety of reasons. So I've moved a little bit in the last few years from focusing on transparency to focusing on software automation to bring a more business approach to government, allowing the government to use software automation to take mundane tasks away from people, like, you know, people sitting in front of computers and typing in Excel spreadsheets all day, to allowing computers to do that. And I know there's one, it's starting to get it. It's only been in the federal government for 4 years. And I co-founded this, really, it's the only one in the country. It's called the RPA Initiative. It's designed to get more software automation into government at all levels, federal, state, and local, because it's unbelievable. I did a webinar with the former head of GSA who brought in software automation to GSA. And he had like, I think, 50 processes that they did. And he said to me, well, we calculated just on back of the envelope, we saved 200,000 hours of labor time.
Oh my cow.
Now that's just one agency.
That's incredible.
And part of the agency. Think about what this could do if it went across government. Plus it serves people better because how many times are you asked to fill out the same form? And you might make a mistake when you're doing, I know I make mistakes when I use the computer all the time. I hope to minimize that, but I don't. But you know, you sign your name wrong or you put some wrong information in, suddenly you have two records.
Right.
And no one ever figures out a way to say, how can we get rid of one?
Yeah.
So all this duplicity, it's mundane. It also allows, as an economist, we have all these people in government. We're not going to fire them all, but then we can make their lives better and allow them to do higher value things. Like at the GSA, they can go out in the field and find out, is this program working or not?
Yeah.
Does it meet the goal or not? Are there less people hungry or not? And if there are people, more people who are hungry and we're spending more money on trying to get rid of hunger, we got a problem and we need to fix it because it's not fair to anybody.
Right. Right.
Do you think this administration, I mean, seeing what you're seeing now, you mentioned inflation, you mentioned waste in government, is even capable of pivoting to something like this?
Well, I would like to I know what's going on inside the federal government. I don't know how active the Biden administration, quote unquote, is pushing it. I know Trump started to do it because he's a businessman and there's a lot of automation software in business. He probably was familiar with it in his hotel business, et cetera. The good news is they're really not needed. The bad news is if they did more or made it more of a priority, it would accelerate its adoption. I would generally, without being too critical, I keep questioning, is it that they're just incompetent or is this, and I know it's policy too as an economist. So is it incompetence? Is it policy? It's combination. But even today now we have, you know, this baby formula problem and they want to have a Zoom call on baby formula with all the companies. Or are they just being stupid? I mean, it's all political all the time. They say things that they really don't mean. I don't want to suggest they're lying, but to the average American, they're not telling the truth.
Right.
There's a growing feeling also that so much of this is orchestrated. It's right. Almost like it's on purpose.
Yeah.
To prove a political point of some sort. And it ends up, you know, hurting the populace.
Yeah. I hate to think that there's some mass conspiracy going on to try to undermine America. Because you think it's too complicated to be real. But at the same time, you know, I just read today, there is ample baby formula at all the camps we've set up for all the migrants who are coming here illegally. But we have American moms with one-year-olds racing to countless stores and being told you can only buy one or two cans. That doesn't seem, I know it's a problem with the border, but it just doesn't seem fair and just in my mind.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's a great point.
Well, and then you had a bunch of even our local congresspeople in Arizona and some others vote against $40 billion for aid in Ukraine. The idea of, and I think it's an interesting point. I think they made a good point. You know, we're going to send $40 billion to Ukraine, but meanwhile, we can't let American mothers have baby formula.
Right.
Where are our priorities?
Yeah. And, you know, the Ukraine people have it tough. They're being invaded by Russia.
No doubt.
Russia is brutal. But even some of the things in that bill, when you read them, are crazy. There was some money put aside for, like, researching something. And you're like, is that a weapon? Can you physically hold it and fire it at an enemy? No.
Yeah.
Well, it shouldn't be in there then. You know, the American people.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a clean bill.
And missiles there so they can defend themselves. Not we're doing research back home for some future period of time.
So well, go ahead, Chris.
No, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to do another segue. Maybe it's not a segue. Maybe it's just a question. What is your favorite thing about using your experience in an academic setting?
My favorite thing is teaching what not to do.
Hmm.
You know, not that I'm known for my successes, but I try not to talk about my failures. And I'm probably like a broken record with the class because I'll say, here's what you need to do to succeed. And don't do this because you're going to fail because I did it and failed miserably. You know, we don't write a book on all of David Ferrer's failures, but there's probably a lot of them.
Well, sometimes I guess you have fewer than others.
Crazy idea. And when I was at the NAB, I came up with plenty of crazy ideas. And I had some staff who would look at me and go, David, it's a little out there. You may want to rethink that.
And with your students these days and you know what you're seeing and the diversity of students, what are you finding they're most passionate about in terms of wanting to get into public policy? What do they want to achieve?
Right. That's
what do they hope to achieve?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit different with the graduate students and undergraduate students. The graduate students, of course, are a little more career oriented, but yet a lot of them want to work for nonprofits. They want to go towards more cause oriented enterprises. You know, when I was growing up, probably when you were growing up, it was mostly about, we got to make money. We got to make profits. We got to work in business. And I think that's changed. Now, I would argue nonprofits still are profitable because you have to make money in order to do things. But they really want to have that, I just don't want to work 10 hours a day. I want to work 10 hours a day and feel like my life has meaning. That's also true of my undergraduate students, but they're still a little more, I don't want to say not more visionary in what they want the world to look like ideally, not necessarily how it is.
You know, they haven't gotten the reality enough.
Right. And you don't want to say, okay, that's a good point, but here's how it really happens.
Right.
You know, they haven't started paying their taxes yet.
Yeah. You know, I do think for most of my undergraduate students, I don't want to rid them of the passion they have for wanting to change the world for the better. But sometimes some of that passion involves reducing the rights of others. And I'm like, you have to be passionate, but you have to respect other people who might have a differing point of view. You know, I often hear, I'm not a member of the NRA. I believe in the Second Amendment. My son is just enlisted on Wednesday in the ROTC program at James Madison University. Hmm. Very proud of him, but he's firing guns all the time. He's going to be a second lieutenant in the Army. And I'll get a paper on why gun control is important. I'm like, okay, I see that. I'm trying to understand. But remember, it's not the gun. It's the person.
Right.
You know, we have a lot of deaths caused by knives in this country. Are we going to ban knives? And then are we going to ban other dangerous products? You always have to stay focused on the individual who is accountable for their actions.
Right.
And I think that's the start of it when they're like, well, you know, all these rural people. I'm like, well, there are 200 million guns in America and 90%, 95% of people are law abiding. The people who aren't law abiding really don't care what you think about gun control because they're going to get the guns illegally anyway and use them.
Right. No amount of gun control is going to stop the criminals from.
Yeah, that's right.
From doing it.
Must be an interesting discussion, regardless. You know?
It is, and I mean,
especially being in D.C., where I'm sure a lot of those issues are just at the forefront.
Yeah,
with crime exploding and gun violence obviously being an issue, but then you're in Virginia, where I mean, there's a gun on every corner, and everyone's packing.
Yeah, in Northern Virginia, less so.
But if you go out to like
Arlington County, just the mothers of Arlington County who are pro-gun control just prohibited a gun store from moving in and selling guns because they thought their kids walking by them and just seeing the windows would be too dangerous. So we have.
They might actually.
They're treating them like porn shops now, right?
Yeah.
What
this gets crazy here.
Yeah. So what do you've been teaching for a little bit? What's been the biggest change in how students are approaching education or the pursuing their future careers from when you started teaching to now?
I think the advent and increase of social media use and the lack of attention span hurts education.
Yeah.
You know, you used to read a book, you used to like listen to a tape, maybe watch a PowerPoint. Now you want it in seconds. You know, you want to touch it, have the answer come up, and then move on. Yeah. And sometimes being thoughtful means you have to spend time being thoughtful. And I think a lot of that has been dissipated, which is unfortunate. Now, the good news is you get the answers faster, but then you can go into the whole argument of, are you really getting the answers or are you just getting someone's spin on what the answers really are? You know, the whole question of what's truth, what's not truth, what's fake news, what's not fake news. I have one assignment I give the undergraduates asking them to find an example of fake news and explain why the media is wrong.
Oh,
fascinating. So what responses do you get? What are some of the examples?
I get the Hunter Biden laptop. I get, you know, Trump. I get like some healthcare issues. I just had a paper on COVID and some of the things not explained to people on COVID. Because my point to them is I always want them to assess personally what they think the media is trying to educate them on. That just because they say it doesn't mean, oh, they're the media, therefore they're telling me the truth. Because really truth, the portrayal of truth is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
Unless it's like, it's 12 o'clock at night here, it's dark. You look out the window, you go, okay, it's dark. Everyone agrees it's dark. But a lot of things, particularly in our highly politicized country now, is spins on what people think, how they interpret it, what really is happening, and what the truth really means to them.
Well, that feels like it's been a real transformation in the quote-unquote mainstream media, is that there's just less straight news, and there's just a lot more spin.
Yeah.
I mean, across the board.
Yeah. I would say that for a whole lot of reasons. Particularly,
yeah, the news has just become something, it's not to inform anymore. It's just
right.
It's just all opinion.
It's like other media. It's like going to a movie.
Yeah.
You want to be entertained. And you have I actually did a study on Twitter before Twitter, maybe 5-6 years ago. Twitter is mostly followed by, one, the media that used it to try to break news. But secondly, left of center Democrats all talking to each other. And there are some conservatives on there as well. But it overwhelmingly was young, relatively inexperienced in life, responding to things. And I don't think you can really explain what's going on in Ukraine in 140 characters 10 years ago. It takes a little more depth than that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. It blows my mind how much the media is relying on Twitter as the driver of what is news. And it is absolutely not reflective at all of people, of the nation. I mean, that, Twitter is a totally different place than reality.
Yeah. But, if you think about it, it's all, with me, life is all about incentives. Think about if you're a local reporter and you want to keep moving up in your job. You have to write what you want your editors, you think you want your editors to know about. They have to edit what they think the publisher wants to know about. So it becomes a self-reinforcing kind of philosophy of, we're just going to be left of center on news because that's what everybody above us want to hear. And it really is true. You go to the cocktail parties in Washington and you deal with all these elite people. And, I have respect for everybody, but they don't live like normal people. They don't go to the gas station. They don't probably even put gas in their car. So they're like, gas prices? I take Uber everywhere.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
They just,
or I have a driver.
Or you can be like Sean and just drive a Tesla.
Drive a Tesla. Yeah. Proudly. David, what's the best advice that you received as a young, either in college or on the Hill or early in your life or in your career?
Kind of that formative career advice that everyone needs to think about. Yeah. So I would say, number one, work hard. You can become a differentiator by just working hard. You get in early, you stay later than everybody else, and you work smartly, but you work really hard. Because people will notice that, and that pays off, or it creates more opportunities for you.
Right.
Number two, I think, is always be open to every different perspective, because you can learn things. Like, I'm always open to people I disagree with. They know where I'm coming from. I know where they're coming from. But sometimes, and more often than not, they teach me something that I don't know. There are occasions, even as an economist, that markets don't work, or that people in business are corrupted, and therefore we need to have an institution like the government check them so they don't make the whole system go bad. Thirdly, I would say be focused. So many young people want to do everything. They want to do this, they want to do that, they want to do this, and suddenly they wake up and they're in their late 20s or they're in their 30s, you know, I'm not saying that when you're in high school, you're going to say, I'm going to be an astronaut. My whole life, I'm just going to spend being an astronaut. But don't just be so thin, you know, you're an inch thin, but a mile long. Be like 10 feet deep, 10 feet thick, but maybe not a mile long.
Yeah.
So that'd be another piece of advice. And I, you know, being, we talked earlier in the podcast about being nice to people. There are so many people that I've been just nice to. Years go by. I'll tell you a quick story. So a very good friend of mine just wrote a book on supply chain disruption and how associations can help businesses maximize their economic growth. It's a great book. He's a really good guy. He's very thoughtful. He used to work for Newt many years ago, so we have this affirmation between us and commonality.
Right.
So I sit down. My wife's with me. She's really never met any of my, other than a few of my beer friends, never really met anybody in the industry. And she sits next to a woman with a spirits company who I had met years ago, but I really don't remember her. And she said to my wife, you know, what I really liked about your husband is even though we adamantly disagreed about things and he fought tooth and nail to protect the beer wholesalers and to make sure the spirits industry didn't make market inroads, he was always a super nice guy. And I knew if he said something and he meant it, he wouldn't tell lies. And I, of course, said, well, thanks. That was so nice of you. Thanks. She said, you know, David, we always knew that you were truthful. And I would say maybe another point people need to think about is don't play games with people. Just be truthful. Sometimes it hurts. Sometimes it helps. But you never have to think back. What did I tell Chris 10 years ago when I saw him at the Marriott at a beer wholesaler meeting? Oh, no, I've got to make sure I'm telling the story the same. You know, I don't have that kind of brain that works like that. I just stick with the truth, and therefore I never have to worry about
it. Yeah, honesty is the best policy by far.
It is a great policy.
Well, even going back to the beer wholesaling part, and you know, I can personally attest to your kindness to a kid who's 25 years old, just lost his dad, and gets thrown into an industry where I have no clue what I'm supposed to be doing, where I'm supposed to be going. And I don't know what you did, but you and your staff just really made a young man feel right at home.
Well, thank you. That was great. Yeah.
You know, and both also because philosophically you and I had a lot in common.
Right.
So we were able to connect on that. And that made it all the better.
Yeah. It bonded us, I think. Yeah. One thing which, you know, we have this diversity, inclusion, equity stuff going on around the country. And I'm a big believer in diversity, inclusion. I am not a big believer in equity because you can never have everybody being
right,
equal.
Right.
And I think it's wrong that we're teaching students that because it depends on your own personality, your force of will, your commitment, your work, et cetera. And I don't want everyone to work at different levels, but have the same outcome being equal.
Yeah.
But having said that, I did a study on association diversity and inclusion. And it was pretty, about 5 years ago, and it was pretty widely viewed. It was the first one ever, and I was really proud of it. Did it with another guy who's a headhunter. But I learned just common decency things, which then you put into practice. You know, one of them, which I'll remember, is always meet new people. You know, when you're in an association or you go to a meeting, typically everybody knows each other, talks to each other. And there's like four or five people who are like new and don't know anybody and are kind of reluctant to meet people.
Right.
So I then took it upon myself every time I go to all these association meetings or these big lunches they have, recognizing people, always looking around the room and go, who's not talking to a lot of people? And then when I find maybe a couple or a single guy or maybe a single gal, I'll just walk up to them and say, hi, I'm David Rare. I'm a professor at George Mason. I used to run Two Association. What brings you here today? So you can engage them and make them feel welcome.
Yeah.
And I think if we all worked harder at making people feel welcome, there would be a lot more diversity and inclusion in the country, which is good. But we wouldn't make it a, you know, you're this type of person or you're that type of person or you're left-handed. And therefore, we're going to hire you over a right-handed person because I think that breeds a lot of contempt.
Yeah.
For others.
Great point.
Yeah, David, it's a slippery slope our country may be going down.
Yeah.
Well, David, we couldn't be happier to have spent some time with you. Yeah, where can people find you?
We can keep talking.
Yeah. Where can people find you? The one thing I will say is that you are available for speaking engagements. And I think anyone would be smart to have you come in and speak to their company, their association, their group. Where can people find you?
So they could most easily find me by sending me an email. It is drehr, R-E-H-R, at GMU, George Mason University, .edu. That's the quickest way. I'll respond. I respond to all my emails except for junk. I'd love to talk to people about this, whether they want to find out what lobbying's really like, what's going on in Washington. I'll talk to students. I just want to spread the message, most importantly, that America is an exceptional country. It offers a lot of people the opportunity to do well, or why would so many people wanting to get in this country, both legally and illegally,
right?
Because they recognize it's better a better place to go than where they came from.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you.
It's great seeing you guys again. Say hi to everybody. And, you know, Chris, when you run into those beer wholesalers, just tell them David thinks about them. I mean, they're wonderful people. They're a backbone of this country. I think about them all the time and just send them my best.
Well, yeah, I'm re-engaging in the industry a little bit after 6 years. And so it should be interesting. What I'm learning is that, you know, we talked about it a little bit before. It's changing, but so much has stayed the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, David.
Thanks a lot.
Take care, everybody.
Thank you, guys. Have a great day. Bye.
See ya.